This week marks 10 years since the civil war in Syria began. A peaceful protest spiraled into a conflict that has involved world powers, including the U.S. and Russia, and it's claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and triggered what the U.N. Refugee Agency calls the world's largest refugee crisis. CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon has gone to Syria to follow the war and its impact on Syrians many times in the last decade. She joined us today from Istanbul, Turkey, on Skype to talk about her reporting. And we have this warning, we'll be hearing some graphic descriptions of violence. She told us what she found on a recent trip to Idlib, Syria, and how it compared to other trips she's made.
Well, on this trip back, a ceasefire had been in place, basically for about a year, that held and has been holding for a lot longer than any of those in the past. And so what we were able to see is what happens to a population when they are given that level of breathing room. That being said, you still have well over 1.5 million people living inside these refugee camps who have been struggling because of border shutdowns and financial aid drying up because of COVID-19. And looking at many of them as we were driving through Idlib and looking out at the children, especially the younger ones, what one is really struck by is how they don't know what it's like to sleep inside a warm bed. They sleep in tents on thin, threadbare mattresses. The space outside of the tent is dirty, dusty, or turns into thick mud whenever it rains. It gets bitterly cold at night. Showers aren't showers. It's, you know, a trickle of water, a bucket poured over your head. A hot meal is cooked, you know, either outside on a burning fire or inside in what can be quite dangerous at times, you know, small little kerosene canisters. I met a 13-year-old girl, so she would have been 3 when the war started. She had lost her father early on. He was detained by regime forces, she said. And then a few years later, her left leg was blown off by a mine. And I asked her, do you dream of a world without war? She said, no. I said, why? She was completely silent. And then I asked her, can you dream of a life without war? And she said, no. And that's just so striking. This girl cannot dream of a life without war because she does not know what that looks like.
And one of the things in that report that comes out is that the reason that she lost part of her leg is that their home, the family home, the outside gate had been laced with mines, and they didn't even know that. I mean, this is how close they are to the conflict.
Exactly. And so this family had actually fled from their home because the area where their home was, you know, a front line. It would go back and forth between rebel control, regime control. And so their house had actually been destroyed in an airstrike, and she had gone back with some of her cousins and other siblings with her grandfather to try to see what they could salvage from the rubble. And so they did not know that the outside wall of their home and the gate itself had been daisy chained with mines. And she was playing hide and seek, and then she went and she was swinging on the gate, you know, kind of holding on to it and just rocking back and forth. And that's when the mine went off.
There's a little boy that you met, Sultan, who's 10 years old, as old as the war itself. And as you say, he too represents a generation of children who've known little but trauma. He at least was able to leave. Unfortunately, it's because of really severe burns that he had suffered. You spoke with him and with his mom in their apartment in Turkey, where he is right now. Let's hear a little bit of your narration from that report.
Sultan was playing on his bike when a rocket blew up fuel canisters nearby. An ambulance brought Sultan to Turkey. He and his mother have been there ever since.
I wonder how he's getting through. How is he doing?
What we were really taken back by when we met him, because, you know, all that we really initially knew was that we were going in to meet this little boy who was 10 years old, who'd suffered horrific tragedies, who had been wounded. So the expectation was, because we've met so many other children in similar situations, was that he would be similar to them. And by that, I mean, you see the innocence of childlike joy deadened. They're often very sullen and angry. And so when we walk into this apartment, and we meet him, and he breaks out into this smile that just captures your heart. His eyes are sparkling. He's playing with Play-Doh and making us little hearts out of it. He's talking about how he wants to be an architect because he wants to build his mother a beautiful home, the home of her dreams. But then you do see the darkness coming in. You do see his face physically change as he remembers the past because of everything that he's been through. So on the one hand, you could say this child is better adjusted than others perhaps who are still inside Syria. But that's not to say that he does not need a lot of help moving forward in terms of how to navigate this, because his mother doesn't know how to help him mentally process everything. She's still trying to process it herself. He needs professional help.
And when you're talking about them needing mental health help, the mother, when you talk about what she has endured, tell us who she's lost in the family and how.
So when Sultan was 5 years old, his baby brother was killed in an airstrike. And his mother, Amar, had put the baby down underneath a window. Airstrike comes in, glass shatters, wall breaks. She screams, goes running in. And as she's talking about this, she just has tears pouring down her face. The neighbors come in and they pull out her baby's body. And then she motions across her neck to show us that her baby's neck had been slit. A year later, her husband says he's going out to the market. He's going to buy vegetables. There's an airstrike on the market. Her husband is killed. 2 years later, so now Sultan is 8. That's when the strike that results in Sultan being horrifically burned happens. And she talks about how she saw him screaming in flames and she didn't know what to do. She didn't know how to put out the flames. What was she supposed to do? Was she supposed to try to fill a bucket with water, find a blanket? She gestures showing us how she begins, you know, trying to use her hands to put out the flames. She's screaming for help. And then she says, I eventually managed to put out the fire, but it was too late. And then what she also remembers is the other children in the town where they live, which was also on a front line, which sustained very heavy bombing, how they saw so many children die, how they tried to save them, and they weren't even able to save a single one. And you can just tell that her pain is so deep. It's gutting her completely and utterly. The only reason why she's holding it together is because of Sultan.
So looking back at the 10 years, you wrote something that I'd like to read a little bit from right now. You wrote, "Long gone is the illusion that any reporting out of Syria will change the realities on the ground. That was painfully eliminated early on. It ripped many of us journalists to shreds, left us flailing, wondering what more we could have done or what we should have done better. It gutted us to hear from contacts and activists who became friends over the years repeatedly ask, 'Why doesn't anyone care?'" Do you feel as if your reporting, telling stories like the ones you've just told us, has made a difference?
Not in the grand scheme of things, and that's been something that's been quite difficult for myself and I think for anyone else covering what was happening in Syria to reconcile. Because if it had made a difference, Syria wouldn't be where it was today. Reporting from Syria is not about giving a voice to the voiceless. It's become about trying to figure out how to get people to listen. And what Syria has taught us is that it doesn't matter how many bodies are pulled out from underneath the rubble. It doesn't matter how many people are killed or displaced or disappeared. It doesn't matter because there were bigger geopolitical games at play. And it's quite tragic when you think that, you know, years ago, people used to ask us, "Why doesn't anyone care?" And you know, when you go back to Syria right now, they don't even ask that question anymore.
Well, we appreciate all your reporting, and I wish you strength as you continue. CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon, covering 10 years of civil war in Syria. Thank you so much.
Thank you.